everyone. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is a Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the popular books and movies they love and the thread of the one reality that they find underneath.
All right. And this is episode number 28.
Yep.
And we're going to talk about a novella called The Life Cycle of Software Objects by Ted Chiang.
Yeah, and this is the second time Ted Chiang has been featured, so he's super special if only 28 podcasts have gone by.
That's right. He is to me.
Oh, yeah.
Boy, everything he comes out with, I've got to read. I just think he's incredible.
He is incredible.
Yeah, and he hasn't written a novel yet. I don't know if he's planning to or not, but he's mainly a short fiction writer. Mm-hmm. Well, not mainly, exclusively, actually.
This is the longest thing he's written, I guess.
I think it is. Yeah.
And it won the Hugo last year, is that right? For whatever category?
Gosh, I didn't look that up. I think you're right, though. I think it did win
something. I'm pretty sure it won the most recent Hugo for whatever, I don't know.
It would have been novella. It would have been the novella category.
Well, then it won. Because I remember on Goodreads, Jenny said that this was the only one that she got right when she was guessing.
Okay. Excellent. Yeah. Yeah, I read it on my Kindle. It's $5 at Amazon, just FYI.
Yeah, and if you look for the book, which I did because I prefer books, which we may get into or not.
Yeah, but we ought to get into that at the end. That'd
I guess it kind of relates, really, doesn't it?
It does.
But, it's like $150 or some outrageous price where you're just like, did they print 12 and hand bind them and hand them out to their friends? That's it? So,
the book was printed by Subterranean Press.
Yeah, it was a short
which does a really great job. Yeah, they do limited runs, and their books are gorgeous. Man, I've got a few of them.
Are they?
They are gorgeous. And, so that's what they specialize in is limited editions. Ted Chiang wrote one called The Merchant and the Alchemist's Gate.
Oh, my gosh, I'd love to have that book.
Yeah, and I don't recall if Life Cycle of Software Objects, I don't recall if that appeared anywhere else, but Merchant in the Alchemist's Gate appeared in Fantasy and Science Fiction magazine, and Subterranean Press at the same time did a limited edition of that one.
Okay.
And so it's just interesting kind of how they're doing that.
To me, that's one we could talk about also sometime. I forget about it because I never saw it in print. I heard that one on Starship Sofa.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
And
I don't think there is an audio version of this one, is there? I haven't heard of one.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah,
that'd be a fun one to read.
Over at SFF Audio, we've called for an audio version of Stories of Your Life, the whole collection that Ted Chiang has put out.
I keep meaning to write to Ted Chiang and ask him if I could at least read that story, Stories of Your Life.
Oh,
but
I
don't know how you would do the part with the equations.
I'm sure we could work that out.
Yeah, and he doesn't seem to mind doing, letting people read it. I probably couldn't do it justice, but.
Oh, yeah. What a good story.
Yes, you could. Wonderful story.
You could do it justice.
Come on. Well, let me just angle for some more compliments.
All right.
That never gets old. But the thing about this story is it reminded me of the fact that I was just reading a short story collection called In the Stacks, and it's stories about libraries and librarians. Mm-hmm. And I was so excited when I started reading it because there were three stories in a row or four stories in a row that I just loved. And then the style of stories they picked changed completely. Instead of being about books so much and ideas, it was about relationships, which to me was, it was about women's relationships. And I'm sorry, I'm not a girly reader. It was so boring. And it picked up again at the end. But I thought, most short story collections, because of the variety of stories, I find it's hard to like all the stories. Yeah. And the only collection I've ever read where I liked every story would be things like The Martian Chronicles or Ted Chiang's The Story of Your Life and others.
Yeah.
And because he just is a superb craftsman as well as having the artist's vision of the heart of the story.
Yeah. There's only two other authors, and you mentioned one of them, that I think are as good at the short form as Ted Chiang, and that's Harlan Ellison and Ray Bradbury. So Harlan Ellison, Ray Bradbury, and Ted Chiang are the three very best short story writers, in my opinion.
I have not read many short. In fact, I don't know if I've read anything by Harlan Ellison. I guess that's something I should rectify.
Yeah, I would. I would highly recommend Audio, and we can talk about that off the air. But he is a tremendous narrator, and he's got.
He does his own. Then.
Yeah, five collections out, and the first one, which I have, and I could send to you.
That'd be great.
Yeah, really tremendous. But Harlan Ellison is a different. Type of guy.
I've heard intense.
So
I keep wanting to see that documentary that you mentioned a long time ago on SFF Audio about his life.
Yeah,
or about
Dreams
him,
with
I
Sharp
guess.
Teeth is what that's called.
Yeah, because he's such a wild man.
He is.
And then you have Ted Chiang, who seems to be just a normal software engineer, very just regular guy. I mean, in terms of he's not flamboyant and.
Yeah, he seems to be pretty quiet, and you know, I've seen him kind of talk on video just once, if I remember right, and most of the interviews I've heard an interview of him, but most of the interviews that I've been able to find of his are in print. So, yeah. So this book.
Yeah, I was going to say.
I'll go ahead
I
and summarize this. Yeah, it opens with a character named Anna Alvarado. Who in their past got laid off from a job at the zoo. And she decided that what she wanted to do was go ahead and go back to school rather than try and find another job in the zoo. So she goes back to school in some kind of a software specialty. So the book opens with her out of school and she's looking for a job. In fact, she lines up a job interview and it falls apart. So she's a little bit bummed out and, she goes online to the virtual world where a lot of characters spend a lot of time in the future. In the future in this book anyway. Mm-hmm. So I picture it kind of like Second Life, which I logged into one time and messed around with and was done. I think I went on there actually because there was an author event. George R.R. Martin was going to do a reading on Second Life. So you showed up in a room and he would be there and you could hear him read. Anyway, but that was my sole experience. I was done at that point. Okay, anyway, so this Anna Alvarado, she's out there in the virtual world and one of her friends comes by and says, hey, I've been asked to get a hold of you because I think I've got a job for you. And the reason, you know, it is a software job, but the reason that the people are excited about you is because of your previous job. Which is that you used to work at a zoo. So she's, you know, definitely interested. Yeah. And they go and she's in this virtual world. They go into a room. And in this room, there are these little animals that are playing with blocks and things. And it turns out that this company that wants to hire her are creating these things called Digients, which are digital pets that have intelligence. And they want
to
hire.
Have the capacity to learn.
Mm-hmm, exactly. What they want Anna to do is to come up with training regimens and nurturing methods to help them raise these digients into. They're basically like real pets or even children, human children almost. And they want to learn. How to raise them.
Right.
So that's going to be her job. And then there's another character named Derek who designs the icons and things, basically how these characters look. You know, I call them characters or digients. These digients look and that you can get like a panda bear and people, you know, somebody wanted a robot. But when they actually start selling, when the company actually starts selling them, there are a number of varieties that you can get. And none of them are the same. They all kind of come from the same kind of programming matrix, but just like, you know, human genetics, there are variations in every instance. And so if you were to go and purchase one for yourself, the first thing to note is that they're not finished. It's not like you're getting something that's raised and complete. You've got to, if you buy it, you've got to nurture just as if it were a real pet. You've got to pay attention to it. You've got to raise it, basically.
Right.
And teach it what you want it to know. And, you know, what it learns can determine, you know, kind of how it turns out. Well, people start to get attached to these Digians, especially Anna and Derek, because they spend so much time with them. They really just kind of fall in love with them as if they were their own kids.
Yeah, they each have their own.
Yeah, and they each have their own. So what happens with software that Ted Chiang goes ahead and explores is that things change so fast that your compatibility, your continuing compatibility with other systems is a problem. So just like some things that would run on Windows 95 won't run on Windows 7, their Digients eventually won't run on other systems. So their company ends up folding. Anna gets to keep the Digient that she was spending the most time with, and Derek keeps a pair of the ones that he had. And basically they and a small group of people around the world have this little users group that they keep going, and they manage to keep these Digients running on systems that they keep running. And the story becomes about them trying to get someone to help them write software that would allow these Digients to work on the new stuff that's out there. So,
yes. So I did want to mention, back up for just 1 second and say that one of the reasons the company folds, which is kind of key, I think, is that people like the novelty of teaching these Digients at first.
Mm-hmm.
But then after a while, that gets to be too much work for some of them. And so they start putting them into suspended animation.
Right. A lot of people end up doing that.
And the way the company made money was selling.
Play with them for a while and shut her down. Yeah.
Yeah. The way the company was making money actually was selling the food and the other things, not the Digients. So
right.
It kind of also looks at commitment.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
it sure
even
does.
Though these are considered toys, what you discover is that for these people who keep hanging on, these are anything but toys. They are actual real personalities, real intelligent beings.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
I'm sorry I interrupted.
No, that's perfect. Okay. In their search for anyone to help them do this, I'm not sure how much more detail to go into at this point.
I was just going to say, I think that's probably okay. Plenty.
Okay. That's basically the story.
Yeah, because what it does is it explores Derek and Anna both have different attitudes and thoughts about their Digients and how you raise or deal with them, because Anna's coming from the animal background. Derek, well, he's just coming from a human background. He doesn't have that animal training at all. And then other people come in who have different ways of looking at them. And so what you start to see is how is everybody interacting in all this? And the other thing I thought was kind of funny too is when you're looking at them going on and exploring all this, Anna's looks like a robot.
Mm-hmm.
Jax is a robot form.
Yeah.
Not an animal form.
Okay.
So to me, I was suddenly, I don't think I realized that the first time I read it. And the second time through, I was like, oh, this isn't a cute little animal. It's an adorable little robot. So that makes the alienness just kind of a little emphasized.
Yeah.
You know, that there's something else.
Right,
that
right.
What we start thinking of them as, because we're looking at them through their owner's eyes. But it's kind of, I don't know how you sum it up to make it, it's just a fascinating exploration of so many things and about digital versus real, I guess you would say, or virtual world versus real, and the interaction between them and what's real where.
Yeah. And then the real concrete limitations of hardware and software that people are running into right now.
Right. Exactly.
And will continue to run into. And then there's some human interaction too, of course, you know, between Anna and Derek, and how the virtual world actually affects the real world.
Yeah.
Because the experiences you have in the virtual world actually are experiences. And you know, so many people treat things differently when they're out there in the virtual world, but it turns out, you know, hey, it's all one thing.
Well, and I don't think this is spoiling anything to say, one of the really coolest concepts I thought was they all have these little robot bodies that they can buy or use, and the Digients can come out of the virtual world into the real world, into their being can be downloaded or uploaded, whatever it would be, into this robot. So they can walk around, and it's got texture pads so they can feel the texture of stuff and run around in the real world and see what it's like.
Mm-hmm.
And watching them adjust to that is interesting.
Yeah, it's all fascinating.
You know, how they go back and forth and what they think about it. And so he's really exploring that back and forth, as well as, once again, with the best science fiction. I guess this is what you were getting at before in your comments. Mm-hmm. But what does it mean to be human?
Yeah.
And I guess at this point, I saw Jesse was, or heard him maybe saying he hates the word spoilers.
Mm-hmm.
and it did make me think, there was a study, and I don't know how valid it was or what the sample it was, maybe a year ago, that said that actually spoilers for most people don't really spoil things.
Yeah. Yeah.
Knowing the big events doesn't really spoil it. But I like to uncover those big events for myself. That's part of what stories are designed.
That's part of the pleasure of it. That's part of the pleasure of it. Yeah. So that's why we do what we do. We summarize the book, and then we go ahead and if you want to read the book before we start talking in depth, then this is your spot.
Yep.
So, and off we go.
Yep.
So that was it's a fascinating book. And again, like I said, you know, this is just what great science fiction does. When I read this, I get excited about science fiction. Just because it's rooted in stuff that we know today. It's not like foreign in any way. I mean, everything that he's talking about, you know, and I write software for control systems, and the concepts that he's talking about are real concepts that are going on right now. You know, when I went to college, I graduated in 1991. When I went to college, I specialized in control systems. And the way that they were teaching us back then to control things was, you want to reduce everything to a mathematical formula so that you can put something in and get a control out. So if you are controlling, let's say, a dryer, for example, that dries your clothes, you're going to reduce that process to a mathematical formula, and then it's going to dry your clothes the same way every single time. So, but what's going on right now, what they found, there's a guy named Andrew Ng at Stanford, who I saw a video, and I'll link to it in our show notes.
Mm-hmm.
But he was demonstrating what they found. He said, okay, what is one of the most difficult things to control on the planet right now? And one of the things, the answers that he gets a lot is a helicopter. It turns out that a helicopter is really difficult. When a human controls a helicopter, they're using two hands and 2 feet.
Oh.
And it's kind of a delicate balance that these human operators do. So, of course, what they did to try and control a helicopter using a computer is they reduced it down to math. And they said, okay, when this happens, you got to do this. When this happens, you got to do this, using mathematical formulas. So he showed a video in which, you know, this meticulously crafted software, they lift, it's a model helicopter that's a pretty big size. You know, there's no people in it, of course, but it's a pretty big size. And they remote control it into the air, so it's hovering maybe 5 feet off the ground. And then they kick on the controls. And the computer, it immediately starts to waver, and it's just about to crash when the guy pulls the plug in on the controls and takes it back with his hands. So Andrew Ng says, okay, so what we learned there is that we need a new method. And the method is, what if instead of telling the computer how to run a helicopter, we design software so that it can learn by itself how to fly a helicopter? So
it understands the overall goal, and then it adjust the systems itself in order to achieve the overall goal, I guess.
Exactly. It's learning itself. Oh, so it's doing intuitive. It's doing things like, okay, when I do this, what happens? When I do that, what happens? And just like a person would. And they call that machine learning.
And did it work?
And it worked.
Are they doing
Not
it
only
now?
Did it okay. work, but in the when they put that software in there, you know, and it took time, but after that, they can fly it upside down. It's so good that it can fly upside down, which, as I understand it, is an incredibly difficult stunt for a human to do.
As somebody who's married to someone who's so into airplanes and stuff, mm-hmm. and has listened to many a comment about helicopters when they come up in movies and TV and how unrealistic things are, I will tell you yes.
Mm-hmm. You bet. So this, the video, it's about a 15-minute video, and it shows... Okay, and here's what we did. And it shows that the helicopter's hovering, and you're like, wow, that's pretty nice. And then the camera flips over, and it pans out, and you can see that it's upside down.
I can't wait to show that to Tom. He's just going, he's going to be so excited to see that. He's going to, he loves computers. He loves airplanes and stuff.
Yeah.
And see, the funny thing is so you've got that aspect of it. Mm-hmm. And the aspect I come from is kind of the other one that's covered in here, which is, I don't do this myself, but one of the things our graphics design company does is work with making websites. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we graduated considerably before 1991. So when we started our little business, it was with the idea that, hey, there's this thing out called PageMaker. And maybe we could do typesetting in the computer instead of using machines for it. So we've been with graphic design from the beginning of the computer idea of it that way. Mm. But now what's happening is they're constantly shifting. In a way, it's kind of like what these people are dealing with, oh, now we've got this system to deal with. Can we translate it? Because they're having to look at all the different websites we do. And Tom is getting ready to make a presentation to the Galleria, which is a big luxury mall around here that we do their website, and say, look, I'm going to show you the tracking. 45% of your web hits are now mobile. Well, that's a whole different way of translating everything so you can look at it on a big screen, because the iPad's considered mobile, mm-hmm. and on your phone.
Yeah.
How do you do the frameworks? How do those translate? What can you put in that? So it's that kind of, how do you translate all these things everybody wants into a completely different way of looking at it? Because no one understands that. And to me, when I read this story, I didn't even think about the control aspect, which really opens it up for me. But I was thinking about the thing of, I understand games. I understand moving to different systems. But I also understand when they're saying they would change the way the robots looked. I was thinking of Jax a lot, but the Digians looked to translate into their older mindset.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking of it kind of like that. I was like, oh, okay. And, you know, how do people relate to that? Do they even notice? Is it kind of an organic thing?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, and that's, I think, where the genius of Ted Chiang is he takes this stuff that we've talked about from two different sides, mm-hmm. and then he puts humans in there, and you've really got, you know, the human aspect of technology, which is so often missed. You know, it's explored a lot in science fiction right now, but there's something about the way that he does it that just blows me away.
Yeah. He cares about people somehow in a way that, and he understands exploring people somehow in a way that you just don't see. A lot.
Yeah.
I mean, because no one who listens to this regularly is going to be surprised when I say I got to the end of this and I was crying. Because it was a beautiful, hopeful, but complex way to end it that was so evocative of parenthood, of one's own maturity, of, you know, all these things to try to do the best for the other person. I think what he understands is love.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. And the first story I've read of his, I'm sure I said this in the last one, is Story of Your Life.
Oh.
And when I read that, I was blown away by that too. But yeah. I would say the same statement about that story.
Mm-hmm.
Without question. So, well,
Yeah. But boy, it's hard to know where there's so much. And it's hard to think how such a short story had so much. And I would look at other people's reviews and they were either like us, super blown away, or they were kind of 3 stars. It was fine, but it just seemed kind of cold to me. And I'm like, what story did you read?
Yeah.
How could you say that?
That's something else.
Yep. But I was wondering if maybe I feel it more because I have kids. Because a lot of what you see Anna and Derek going through is the experience of raising children without actually raising children. Because it's funny how the perception changes as they themselves will realize they're not dealing with what they thought. At first, you kind of think of them like cute little pets.
Yeah, they're sold. There was a character who said something like, all of the fun of monkeys, but no poop throwing.
Right.
You know, so this is kind of how they were being sold to people as pets. Right.
And they're just adorable, yeah, the way they talk and they learn. And you get to love these characters also. And then you start thinking of them as children and teenagers as they get older. And they're mm-hmm. asking more sophisticated questions and showing that they're doing independent thinking and understanding how the world works. And they're surprising mm-hmm. Derek and Anna with the things they come up with, which to me is highly reminiscent of my own children.
Yeah.
They get to be a certain age and they start, I didn't tell you that. You put that together yourself, you know. And then what each of them has to realize at different points is Anna will suddenly go, whoa, these are digients. They're their own thing. They're not animals. That's how I was thinking of them. And Derek later goes, wow, they're digients. They're not children. This is, you know, and then by the end of the book, they realize that these creatures, I guess you would call them individuals, understand themselves better than their parents do, or better than their owners, or mm-hmm. I don't know what you call them. They're not really owners by the end.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
And it's kind of, it's very equivalent in that way to watching your children grow up and going, they're their own people. All I can do is, have I provided a good foundation? Here you go, you're launched. And that's kind of, by the end of the story, that's kind of where they are. And you're watching the parents both, because they don't have anyone to help them. In fact, it's caused problems with their actual relationships from people who don't understand it. They'll tell each other, well, I think of it like this, and so I'm going to allow them to do that. And the other person will go, oh, that is a good way to think of it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's like parenting also.
Yeah, sure.
One person doesn't have the answer. You have to bounce things off of each other and try stuff to help the person.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's important to remember that these digients are really just pieces of software.
Right.
So they're software, like I was explaining, they're machine learning software. So the software, instead of trying to decide or trying to give you something that's completely formed and finished when you buy it, you know, some type of an artificial intelligence that's already done, what they did is designed a piece of software that can learn and then, you know, let that free. And so that's what the digients are. They're just pieces of software. So they live in this virtual world. So
that can't be. I'm sorry. They were real. Done. You said that. I was like, oh my gosh, he made them so real. I have to reject that. But you're right.
That's right. And that's what makes you think, okay, well, you know, this is something that science fiction has been exploring since forever. I can't remember how old the first robot story is.
That's
RUR by Capek or something like that.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, science fiction has been exploring this possibility for so long. But Ted Chiang's story really seems to me to be really, really possible. You know,
yeah.
Even in iRobot and things, you know, with the laws of robotics and all that stuff, it's interesting, but it just doesn't seem possible. Well,
they're tools also. You know, they have personality and everything.
Right, and in some ways they do act kind of like a computer would act.
Right.
But this one, you know, really seems like it's something that could possibly be achievable. And in one of Chiang's interviews that I read, he said, Well, I'll just read you this paragraph. It says, when people, this is Ted Chiang talking, when people working in the software industry talk about artificial intelligence, they're usually referring to stuff like algorithms for scheduling airport traffic more efficiently. Mm. No one's seriously working toward the type of AI you typically see in science fiction. Some form of conscious software that you can have a conversation with. However, there is a research avenue that seems promising to me involving autonomous embodied agents, i.e. robots, that can sense their environment and learn how to navigate it. I think an approach like that could eventually lead to conscious software, but the AI would have to learn everything the way a human does. Mm-hmm. You can't just download Wikipedia into its brain.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really interesting approach that's fairly new. But again, you know, these things exist just as software. So some of the things that happen that kind of show you that is that they've got what they call a hothouse. And sometimes they would say, okay, what we want to do is accelerate the development of this Digient. So they run the software faster.
Yeah, in the little, for when they were young, right?
Yeah.
To get them to the point where the owners could have them so they're talking and
right.
stuff.
And then some of the things that start to happen when the Digients get out there into the internet is sometimes they're stolen or copied. And people start to do experiments on them. You know, we'll get into that other stuff. But some of the things that they're doing is somebody was wanting to make a society of them. So let's see what happens if we run a hothouse for 1,000 years or something, and just run it super fast and see, like, maybe they get to turn into this incredible society. And usually it would fail. For some reason, the Digients would go wrong in some way. And the society would never flourish.
I thought it was an interesting, that was something that I actually marked that Derek thought when he was looking at all that. He says, well, of course, that makes sense because complex minds can't develop on their own. And I was like, they can't? And then he goes on to say, that's why feral children are feral. Otherwise, they'd be normal if they developed on their own in the wild. And I went, oh, all right. I'm trying to, let's see. I did have that clipped somewhere in my thing. But yeah, I just thought that was a fascinating comment where he's applying human observations to these Digients because they are learning the way humans do.
Right. And isn't it interesting, while you're looking that up, isn't it interesting how Anna and Derek both feel wrong about things like a hothouse or turning their Digients off. Sometimes people would say, you know what, I've just had enough right now. I'm going to go ahead and suspend this Digient, which basically means I'm going to turn him off. Mm-hmm. And I say him, him off, you know, because that's again, that's how you feel about him, that they're persons.
Mm-hmm.
And so he turns them off and then they come back later and they can turn them on again. Well, that is anathema to Anna and Derek. They just, that doesn't really occur to them. It's always brought up by somebody else. Hey, what if we did this? And they're like, no, I really don't want to do that. I don't want to turn them off.
Well, sometimes Anna thinks, yeah, that would be easier if I could just turn off Jax for just a little while we're doing this one thing. And, but she's promised him she wouldn't.
Exactly.
And she's going to keep her promise because they look at them and they say, well, these are, they know in their hearts, I suppose, that these are pieces of software, but they also know that they're intelligent beings.
Yeah.
You know, because they have developed on their own and they can surprise them. And the thing I found here is it says when Derek's talking about the scientists and the test populations that they were doing, he says, the researchers conclude that there's something missing in the origami genome, but as far as Derek's concerned, the fault lies with them. They're blind to a simple truth. Complex minds can't develop on their own. If they could, feral children would be like any other, and minds don't grow the way weeds do, flourishing under indifferent attention. Otherwise, all children in orphanages would thrive. For a mind to even approach its full potential, it needs cultivation by other minds. That cultivation is what he's trying to provide for Marco and Polo.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And to me, I was like, wow, that's, I never thought of it that way, but it hit me again, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But I think, yeah, they respect them as they don't care that they're pieces of software. They respect them for their intelligence and their potential. And for me, okay, just because I have to go into the Catholic thing right now, especially with all the stuff that's going on in the conflicts between the government and the Catholic Church, this is the difference in looking at something as, well, I define it as a soft piece of software, and, well, there's a deeper truth to what's going on. Because they, like all those suspended digients, it hurts Anna every time she thinks of them.
Yeah.
And that made me think of all the frozen embryos out there. Oh. Because to Catholics, that's wrong. Those are actually people. That's what's been done to them. That's the potential that's there. That's there. They have souls. They're ready to grow. And they're just being kept in storage like they're a thing.
Right.
So to me, there were a lot of parallels here when you look at how people are viewing this software world and these intelligences and how hard Derek and Anna are struggling to give let them have their full potential because everybody else does just doesn't understand everything that's there. And that's, to me, a lot of what the Catholic Church gets accused of on the outside of, you know, they're too old-fashioned, they don't understand things, they should modernize. And what the Catholic Church does is go, no, there's a lot more going on here than you understand.
Yeah.
With all these life issues.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And excuse me, another thing from the Catholic perspective that I was thinking is it's going to be an interesting problem for the Catholic Church should AI ever actually come to fruition.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah. I mean, wouldn't that be interesting?
Yeah.
It's just an interesting thing to think about. And again,
that is interesting.
I mentioned Brother Guy Consolmagno, and he's he's talked some about that in the book, but I forgot to kind of look at that before the podcast. But if I can find anything that he has to say, I'll put it in the show notes. But
yeah. But
it's an interesting thing to think about because. I don't know, as a Catholic, I do believe we're more than just the sum total of our experience. But then, you know, you get to a point where, and again, this is all thought process because nothing of the type even exists at all.
Right.
But should you get to a point where you've got a piece of software or a machine that you can talk to and not tell if it's a person or not. That's called the Turing test. Have you heard of the Turing test?
I think it gets mentioned in here, actually.
Yeah. So what the Turing test is if you put a human being in a room and a computer in the other room or an artificial intelligence, whether it be software or whatever, and then a third person talks to the human and the computer and can't figure out one's human or not.
Yeah.
Or whether, he can't tell the difference between the human and the computer. Well, the key part of the Turing test is that you can't tell if the software or machine is a person or a computer. So normally with software right now, it's very, 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 very easy to tell that it's not a human being that you're talking to. Because you can always trap software into saying the same thing twice or things like that.
It's in talking in a stilted fashion or using slang wrong or something.
Yeah, and you could even use a keyboard, if they do it with a keyboard and text, if they can convince you that they're human, it would have passed the test. But they don't at all.
Yeah.
Now, this was an interesting thing that I wrote down here. This is someone who's talking to Anna. Her name is Robin. Robin is talking to Anna about a quarter of the way through the book. She says, cats, dogs, digients, they're all just substitutes for what we're supposed to be caring for. Eventually, you start to understand what a baby means, what it really means, and everything changes. And then you realize that all the feelings you had before weren't, I mean, for me, to just put things in perspective. So, that made me think.
Anna say she's heard this before. This is a real common thing of people to say, oh, animals are a substitute for babies. And she says, well, no, but there's a value to caring for animals. Oh, I'm sorry, I just bumped my computer. But there's a value to animals that is different and valid also.
Yeah, she says, women, well, she doesn't say this out loud. This is just in the book. Women who work with animals hear this all the time, that their love for animals must arise out of a sublimated child-rearing urge. Anna's tired of the stereotype. She likes children just fine, but they're not the standard against which all other accomplishments should be measured. Caring for animals is worthwhile in and of itself, a vocation that need offer no apologies. She wouldn't have said the same thing about Dingians when she started at Blue Gamma, but now she realizes it might be true for them too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's people who, because of their own personal experience, are reducing everything to that. But, you know, there is a mindset these days that tries to, is it overanalyze or just simplify everything to where it's, you know, this is the equivalent or isn't the equivalent of that, or everything's very simple. And really, everything's more complex than people like to think, I think.
Yeah, yeah. It's an interesting time that we live in right now. You know, and this, I'm not saying this is good or bad, but I saw on the news not too long ago, they said something like, it was somewhere around half the adults in the United States live alone.
I know, and that's...
Did you see that same thing?
No, I didn't, but I believe it.
But yeah, I mean, but that was a very interesting thing. You know, our society is changing.
Yeah, and to me, that's a sad thing.
Well, I think it's a sad thing too. You know, what's sad to me, I don't believe that, you know, a person who doesn't have children is living some kind of an empty life. I do, having had children, think, you know, it changes things for you. You know, it becomes... You know, you there's a lot of things that happen, you know, and they're all good, in my opinion. They're all good, but what?
They're hard sometimes, though.
Yeah, oh yeah, without question. But people that live alone, it's the thing that I think about there is that there are kids out there that don't have parents around,
right?
You know, and that's the aspect of it that I think is bad. I think that if you decide not to have kids and you're alone, that's fine. But if you have kids, I think you have a responsibility, and to have kids and not feel that, I think is a terrible thing.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, and this is something that I wind up talking and thinking about a lot, because now that we're back again involved in that Bianca and a marriage retreat. They have monthly meetings where, you know, whoever's interested of the couples who've gone through can come to these meetings, and they're really to help the team that will put on the next retreat bond as a team, actually. But what they do is they support marriage. So you talk about marriage a lot, or we'll read books and things. And then also, since we're helping with that RCIA group, which is, I think I've mentioned before, but if anybody wasn't listening, it's basically the classes in the Catholic Church before you enter the Catholic Church to teach you all the things that they teach and, or, you know, that they hold to be true and why. And we just had a discussion a couple weeks ago about, it was family as a vocation, you know, marriage as a vocation, and also holy orders. And one of the things that a lot of people are surprised about, and I was myself a while back when I discovered it, which is that the Catholic Church teaches that marriage is your vocation if you're married, meaning that it's your highest calling, and that the family is kind of like a domestic church right where you are, because it provides all these opportunities to learn that sacrificing for someone through love brings you to a higher level of being who you should be, to follow in Christ's footsteps. It gives the children an opportunity to observe that love in action so they can start to imitate it and learn how you should be as a Christian. And well, just as a person, because the church's whole goal is to make you the most complete human person that God meant you to be, and you can go to heaven.
Right.
While we're here, we're to help each other. And there's no better opportunity than being in a family and being a parent. And I think that's what this story reminded me of more than anything.
Yeah.
It was watching all that.
Yeah,
and so you talk about all those people who are alone, and most of them, I think they aren't. I know so many single people that I pray for. They aren't alone because they want to be alone. They're lonely.
Mm.
And it's hard to meet people. And the ones I feel sorry for, honestly, are that we have a variety of friends who've chosen not to have children. And I'm just like, you know, I get it. From the outside, it's hard. It's inconvenient. There's things you can't do. You have to change your life. But the thing is it's like that quote from C.S. Lewis that says, you invite God into your heart. And it's like a little cottage, and he's going to fix it up. He's going to fix that drain that didn't work. He's going to put some new paint on the place so it'll be better. He goes, and then pretty soon all this disruption starts, and you realize, no, he's building a castle because he plans on living there. So he's knocking down walls and remodeling, and it hurts.
Mm, yeah.
But that's why, and that's what the family does. And in the end, the reward is way beyond any inconvenience.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like you, I think of the people who either can't have kids and just kill themselves trying in vitro or have chosen not to have kids. And there's all these kids out there just crying out for someone to love them.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
To be adopted or whatever. Sorry, I didn't mean to go on my little passionate. This is so true.
Is it? Yeah. Yeah.
But it really, and it's in the catechism. If you read it, there's this whole long section about all the goods that marriage brings you. And it's really true.
Yeah.
And children.
Yeah, I agree.
And to me, that's like, maybe that's why I liked this so much, that Ted Chiang captured, it's funny, you looked so much at the computer side and the software side, and not that you didn't get the human side, but to me, I kind of forgot all about that. And I was looking at Derek and Anna as developing as parents, but also developing as people, as they themselves realize by the end, okay, like when Derek says, is telling Anna, because Anna's going, I don't want anything bad to ever happen to Jackson, by making him do homework mm-hmm. and learn more. That's just so stressful. And it says, Derek shakes his head and he says, it's not about making them work. It's about getting them to learn some responsibility. And they might be strong enough to take feeling bad once in a while. The only way to know is to try.
Mm-hmm.
She says, why take the chance of making them feel bad at all? And he says, it was something I thought of when I was talking with my sister, he says. Derek's sister teaches children born with Down syndrome. She mentioned that some parents don't want to push their kids too much because they're afraid of exposing them to the possibility of failure. The parents mean well, but they're keeping their kids from reaching their full potential when they coddle them. It takes her a little while to get used to this idea. Anna's used to thinking of them as supremely gifted apes. And while in the past people have compared apes to children with special needs, it was always more of a metaphor. To view the Digients more literally as special needs children requires a shift in perspective.
Yeah.
And so what people from the outside don't realize is there's that shift in perspective. And also, I mean, boy, did he touch on a lot of stuff, because reading that also makes me think of this whole generation of kids who are like my kids' age. So that'd be early 20s. You hear employer after employer complain because they kind of just sit back and expect everything to be given to them. And not every kid, but a lot of them.
Yeah.
They have to kind of be trained to, no, you have to work. And sometimes it's hard and sometimes you fail, because the parents have essentially done what they're talking about here. They didn't let them be pushed enough. They went and battled with the teachers to make it easier. They didn't let them take risks.
Mm-hmm.
I've read of parents who actually will call first-time employers and complain to them. I'm just like astounded. I know.
Yeah.
They'll call their college professors and complain. And I'm thinking, what is wrong with you people?
Yeah, that's nuts.
But it's that kind of, so I'm sorry. I just kind of, there's just so much here.
Yeah, There's so much here. And we haven't even spoken yet about some of the negative human behavior in here.
Oh,
and right. I call it definitely negative behavior.
Yeah, yeah, some people would not want to judge it, but let me just tell you, it's negative.
It's negative. So the
let's go with that.
Yeah, as the Digients get older, I mentioned in the summary that the software starts to become obsolete. So it's just like something that's written to run on Windows 95, for example, and now Windows 7 is out and they're starting to not try to be backwards compatible. So
it's for this, the environment they live in.
Yeah, exactly. So they used to call it Data Earth is the platform on which these run. And Data Earth, just like everything else, something new and better came along. And now Data Earth is basically closing because something new and better is making all the money. All the people are flocking to the new and better.
No one could support Data Earth.
Right, but the Digients don't run on Data Earth. They won't work. So they've got a problem. The company that they were working for that's making the Digients has folded, has since folded for the reasons that we stated. So Anna and Derek still have these Digients as well as a very small users group throughout the world that they kind of keep in touch with each other. So they decide, well, what we need to do is get the software written that would allow these Digients to run on the new stuff. Mm-hmm. So they start to try to figure out, well, how can we do this? And one of the things that happens during this transition is some of the Digients that have been sold get copied. And you get like torture videos and things out there on the internet. And these are like, so, you know, it occurs to Anna, you know, did someone steal a copy of Jax? And now what's this copy of Jax doing? You know, and it just bothers her no end.
Right.
But then as they sit and try to find somebody, you know, it costs a lot of money to do this. And they don't have the expertise themselves, so they go into company to company to company to try and convince them, you know, hey, maybe there's some commercial possibilities here that you guys could exploit and do that. And then I use the word exploit on purpose because up comes this sex company that has decided, hey, you know, these things would probably be pretty cool to have sex with virtually. So they actually come along and they offer, we will do this.
We'll upgrade your software.
We'll upgrade your software as long as you give us copies of these things because they're way better than anything else we have. And what we'll do is we'll give them genders and we'll train them basically to perform pleasurable acts for people. And of course, Anna and Derek are like, gosh, you know, that's just not right. Even though there's that good, it just can't do it.
Well, also, though, they have carefully thought it through. They're not just going to make them into, like, sex toys. They've really thought of the way to develop the Digient software, work with them, so that it will be as good an experience for the Digient as it would be.
Yeah. Exactly.
For the person, I mean, I hate to even dignify that with, but the thing is basically they would do as much as possible to give the Digient the feeling of falling in love so that it's a good thing for them and it's not like a torture thing or they're not somebody's object.
Right. And there's an interesting parallel there going on because Anna has been offered a job at a new company that wants to make new Digients. And they want to not only hire her to train, but they want to give her a drug that will help her attach to a Digient, which is basically hormones and things to make you feel that you've fallen in love with somebody. You know, so like a love potion almost. Mm-hmm. So, but they're wanting to do the same thing to the software of her Digient. And she objects to her Digient being given that, but then accepts, when she thinks that all hope is lost, she accepts that I'm going to go to work for this company. I'm going to take that drug. And the reason that she wants to go to work for the company is because if she goes to that company, she's convinced that she can convince those people to port these Digients to the updated systems. She it's not even a guarantee. She's just convinced that she can do it. She
and can no convince human them. That she knows wants her to do this.
Right.
So it's the same parallel. It's very obvious, but I hadn't thought of it that way.
Yeah. And it's interesting that she was, okay, I'll do that to myself, but I won't do it to this Digient.
And the Digiants, her Digiant, and I think also Derek's, has come to her repeatedly saying, how can I get a job to earn money to help you?
Mm-hmm.
He wants to sacrifice to help her because he loves her, right. You know, as like mm-hmm. a child or a friend or whatever
yeah.
a Digiant feels. But so there's that parallel also. And she's yeah. like, well, you don't want to do that. Oh, yeah, I do. It's okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they also, at that same time, start to explore that idea of becoming independent because Marco and Polo and I guess Jax also want to become incorporated.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
would make them their own individual people.
Right. And one of the companies that was looking at this, once they saw that they wanted to be independent, that was it for them. They didn't want employees. They wanted products.
Right.
So once this Digiant decides to be incorporated, they would have to hire it. And they're like, no, we want products. We don't want mm-hmm. any employees.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So it's just a, yeah, it's fascinating.
But they did have in the independence thing, I just thought of this and I was like, because basically what Anna and Derek are willing to do is allow that their Digiants have free will by the end.
Yeah.
And try to find ways to help them be the most prepared they can to express their free will. Because Marco is talking to Derek and he says, when I corporation, I free make my own mistakes. They talk in this kind of pidgin English sometimes, says Marco. And Derek says, that's the whole point. You're not ready to be a corporation yet. And Marco says, because you not like my decisions, ready mean always agree with you. And Derek says, well, if you're planning on editing your own reward map as soon as you're a corporation, you're not ready.
Mm-hmm.
I not said want, says Marco emphatically. I don't want. I said when corporation, I free do that. That different. And editing your reward map means, you know, you'll change the things that bring you pleasure. And later on, Marco brings up the point that he goes, well, people do this all the time. They take drugs. They do alcohol. I'm like, oh, Ted Chiang thought of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so it, yeah. But basically that makes Derek stop and think. He's like, it has to mean granting autonomy if you're going to let them become a legal person. Otherwise it's just wordplay.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, yes, you're right. When you're a corporation, you'll be free to do things that I think are mistakes. Good, says Marco, satisfied. When you decide I'm ready, it not because I agree you. I can be ready even if I not agree you.
Mm.
And that's when I started going, well, now here are the parallels, though Ted Chiang maybe didn't think of it. I mean, this is obviously parenthood. You have to let your kids go. And if they make mistakes, that's painful. But there you go. But to me, that started lifting the conversation into it suddenly becomes our relationship with God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I agree, too. When that started to happen, I was like, oh boy, you know,
mm-hmm.
but yet it was real. It was very realistic.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what I started thinking of that, and then that brings me to the relationship with the church, and I could see the Catholic Church having, you know, wanting to say something about this like they do. And then I could hear Stephen Fry in a debate one time saying, why are they obsessed with sex? You know, why is the Catholic Church obsessed with sex and all this stuff? And it's like, society is.
Right.
Society is obsessed with sex. I think if you were an alien and you looked down at the United States, you would determine that sex is the most important thing to everybody in this country.
Yeah.
And, that's what the Catholic Church, you know, for them to comment on this and say, guys, this is not the most important thing. This is the most important thing. You know, try to keep your eyes on this because, I don't know, you know, even without the church, it certainly seems to me that there's a whole lot of destructive things going on. Mm-hmm. And, if the church didn't exist, it would still be destructive. And I don't know. It's just, that's what I was thinking as I was reading this. I was like, first of all, I was a little shocked. And mm-hmm. then I realized that this is realistic. And mm-hmm. then I realized that, you know, because I think that it's realistic, it's just a reflection of what's been going on and how everything's just okay. You know, everything's just fine. You know, hey, whatever you're doing is okay. And it just seems like we're headed more and more that direction. And sometimes things are not okay.
Well, and because that's what I was raised with is, as long as you're not hurting anyone, mm-hmm. anything you want to do is fine. Well, the problem is you don't always realize what's hurting someone until it's too late. And this story kind of talks about some of those things. You're free to make your own mistakes. But the reason the church will come up and go, you know what? If I don't warn you about this cliff ahead, you guys are just going to run right off of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the picket fence or the warning sign that goes, you know, dead end ahead.
Yeah.
And people don't want to hear it because they just want the short-term rewards. It's hard to, you know, that hard road of, you know, like, say, being a parent. Well, you don't get all those rewards if you don't go through all that crap first
mm-hmm.
with your spouse, yeah. with the other people. That's part of being a human being. And to try to think we can avoid that and have the easy life, if you avoid it completely, like the people who live by themselves or who don't want to have kids, you can be happy, but it's compared to what it could be, it's not rich. You're not what you could be or who you could be. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like Dean Koontz in one of his characters in the Odd Thomas books kept saying that life is like a boot camp for the next step, which would be heaven. And this is like boot camp, and it doesn't mean boot camp's bad. You can have a great time, you know, and when you come out, you're a Marine or whatever. You're much better off than you were before when you went in, but nobody wants to look at that part, that you have to practice denial and you have to do things for the good of the other person. And then the church is there to remind us, if the church's whole goal, and this is it, is to get us to heaven, then it has to say, you're going down a dead end. This isn't good for you. And we just don't want to hear it because you can't prove it scientifically. But, you know, look at the money that's poured out on things to make people feel better.
Mm.
You know, we're so dysfunctional. Yeah. And sex is a big part of that. You know, before in other generations, it would have been something else. You know, that the church would have been. Some friend of mine was talking about she was marching during, you know, she was in the civil rights marches.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, I was an atheist. She goes, but God bless them. There were the Jewish people and the rabbis and there were those Catholic priests and they were marching too and they were getting hosed. And then she goes, that's when I learned to love the church.
Mm.
They were out there doing it. And she goes, you don't ever hear about that now, but they were out there on the front lines. And so you have to be, I don't know.
Yeah.
You have to be prepared to sacrifice for what's right.
Yeah. Yep.
And you never, you know, when you're not doing the right thing, you don't want to hear it, which I guess is the part of the point of Lent.
Yes, which we are in.
Yeah. The springtime boot camp.
Without a question. So what did you think? What did you think when Derek said, okay, I'm going to sell one of my digients? And when I say sell one of my digients, he actually allowed them to copy it. So he mm-hmm. still had his. But Derek said, okay, in order to prevent Anna from taking this job and taking that drug, I'm going to allow them to copy this. And by them, he means the sex company. And I'm going to allow that to happen so that we can have the good of getting these digients what they need.
If the only reason he had done that was to get the other digients what they need, mm-hmm. I would have rejected it. But his thoughts that he had on what does it mean for a digient to be mature?
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean to allow them to make their own decisions? Does Marco understand? Because Marco is adamant. He wants to do this.
Yeah.
Because he understands the implication that it means that he can mature more. That's what he says.
Mm-hmm.
Derek looks at it from the outside human point of view and says, well, there's no way you could. And then he says, well, how do I know that? He says, perhaps the standards for maturity for a digient shouldn't be as high as they are for a human. Maybe Marco is as mature as he needs to be to make this decision. And he says, Marco seems entirely comfortable thinking of himself as a digient rather than a human. It's possible he doesn't fully appreciate the consequences of what he's suggesting. But Derek can't shake the feeling that Marco, in fact, understands his own nature better than Derek does. Marco and Polo aren't human, and maybe thinking of them as if they were is a mistake, forcing them to conform to his expectations instead of letting them be themselves. Is it more respectful to treat him like a human being or to accept that he isn't one? And the fact that he's having those struggles, and he's always been the one who said, you know what, let's let them do the homework and see if it hurts them. Let's let them take a chance and take a risk and see if this is good for them or not. If he can't see that there's a downside, a definite downside. And I'm like, you know, it's not necessarily good for the people that are involved in it. But from only looking at the Digian's point of view, I kind of had to agree with him because they were trying to make it an experience that, because Anna also later thinks, well, letting them be essentially in love, is that something that will make them more mature, even if this ultimately is a bad experience? And I was like, my gosh, it's like sending someone off for their first boyfriend or girlfriend. It's a different implication because of the sexual aspect, but what it's doing is making them into more complete human type people.
Making him kind of a more humanish type.
From the human but
maybe
point
they,
of view,
maybe they didn't need to be that. It's interesting to introduce the whole idea of gender at all, you know, because they were kind of genderless the entire time.
But that's how kids are until they get to that age.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, you know, you're a boy or a girl, you like dresses, you like cowboy suits or whatever. You play with guns or you play, you know, you want to help mommy cook. But essentially, you are fairly genderless that way anyway. Aren't sexual beings yet. And so the fact that they were trying their hardest to make the best decision to allow them to mature to the fullness of their potential, from the Digian's point of view, I'd have to say yes.
Yeah, interesting. This reminds me of another story I read a long time ago called Code of the Life Makers by James P. Hogan. And it had to do with these robots who... I can't recall if they were sent somewhere on purpose or if they crash landed. They were like going ahead of colonists or something. But the software and the robots had a male side and a female side. And when they came together, they could create offspring. But you had to have a male side and a female side, or two halves of this software. And that was interesting. So they ended up building an entire society on this planet that they were on, for whatever reason they were on it. And without humans there, they a whole society grew up. And then, of course, humans have visited. They got there, and it didn't go as planned.
That's intriguing sounding. Yeah. You can't tell where they went with that. Okay. good job summarizing.
It turns into a writing prompt at that point. It's just so long ago, I don't recall exactly what happened. But I do remember the aspect where, you know, you've got robots and they've got two halves of software that need to come together to create something. So,
well, how did you feel about that decision to make?
Well, I agree with you that, you know, the Digiant really wanted to do it and that should have influenced him. But I, you know, given those two choices, it just didn't seem that there was a good choice.
So if you had to make a choice,
if I had to make that
gun
choice,
to your head, you're Derek.
I Anna. Probably would have done it.
Yeah.
I probably would have done the same thing.
Yeah,
it's tough. Well,
something else that I found interesting about this was just kind of almost a side note in the story, but this was from earlier in the Digian's experience when they say that, you know, they've kind of essentially entered their late teenager stage. And so they've become interested in all these online activities that they could still get to. Like one of them gets real interested in some kind of dancing and the others are both doing different kind of fan club things. And they're interacting completely online the way a lot of games are now. Like, you know, you're talking about, was it Second Life?
Yeah.
Second Life. I was thinking Second Earth and I was like, no, that's Data Earth. But and they were saying that a lot of their good friends were human teenagers who did not care that these were actually just Digiants, because to them they were full, complete personalities. And all of a sudden you could see this world growing up, and this is what Anna was thinking when she was thinking of Corporation. All these generations of people who would grow up experiencing them as real people online would have no problem accepting them as individuals, as actual beings. And it kind of gave her hope.
Yeah.
And so you suddenly, and I was like, wow, that's kind of like bringing them out into the robot and the real world for a while. It gives them a completely different dimension. I hadn't considered that point, that they could be friends with other people besides their owners or handlers or trainers, whatever you call Derek and Anna.
Yep. And that's a cool aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Fascinating.
Well, kind of said something about to me about the way, you know, humans will form all these communities online. Well, kind of like we've done.
Mm-hmm.
And without the traditional ways of, you know, somebody having to be human.
Yeah. Yeah, I could certainly see that happening.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Fascinating. So, yeah, go read this book.
Oh, man.
If you haven't.
Yeah. I know we've talked about a lot of it, but still there's so much that's not talked about. So, yeah,
there's
still
so much there. And it's a novella. Amazing.
Yeah. And when I was reading it the second time, I was able to kind of step back a little and look at the very careful way it was structured. I see why it takes him so long,
mm-hmm.
because it feels very natural. But, you know, he's very carefully taking us from thinking about them as little baby animals. Oh, they could be robots. Oh, it's like they're children. Oh, it's like they're teenagers. Oh, we really care about them as people.
Mm, yeah.
I did anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, me
and,
too.
And when I look at how the story's structured and then all the things he drops in there about people and growing and becoming your own person and individuals and maturing, and it's just like, wow, this story is so amazingly put together.
Yeah, it sure is. It sure is, you know, and that thinking about, you know, it's a piece of software or it's a person, you know, that's something that I've thought about, you know, since I was, you know, probably 13 years old. Reading stories.
And really?
Yeah, it just, you know, what makes a person, you know, is software ever going to become that way? It's fascinating to think about, and to think about what would happen should that occur.
Right.
I mean, there are endless permutations in science fiction, but it's something that possibly could become a real thing, but it's very far away still, if
yeah,
at all.
Yeah, they're certainly working toward it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's going to be a long, long time. They've had nothing come even close yet.
And every time I hear about those things, I just stop and think what amazing creatures human beings are.
Oh, and they are. Yeah.
So perfectly designed. So, you know, with backup systems and all these things, and think about, you know, things go wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But just think about the human being as a creation. Just amazing, because we just can't duplicate that. And for that matter, I mean, I think human beings are wonderful, but I mean, you know, you look at a bird, that kind of thing. It's the same thing as all, you know, there's just life is incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody was saying to me recently, a fellow science fiction fan, she said, you know, everybody always wants the chance to go off and explore all these alien worlds. And she's like, and I think she got this from G.K. Chesterton, but she said, you know what? Our own world is like that alien world. Have we gone out and gone hiking in the woods and just looked at it and thought about it from the point of view of, look what's here that I've never experienced?
Yeah.
Think about the vistas that are available in our own country. I guess I'm saying that because, you know, I saw the Grand Canyon and we drove across the Southwest, and it was amazing.
Yeah, it sure is. You know, yeah.
Under the sea and up in the mountains.
Yeah, under the sea, yeah. There's life on this planet in the most unexpected places.
Yeah.
I was following on the BBC. They've uncovered a lake in Antarctica that's been untouched by air for millions of years is what they think.
Uh-huh.
So I can't wait to see what they find in there. They drilled through the ice and found the lake.
Well, it's like... gosh, I guess this was a radio lab, and it was called, I think it was called something like the Yellow Fuzzy and Other Curiosities or something like that. It's an older one. And one of the people they talked to is somebody who actually does do that, going to the Antarctic, and they look for like life near heat vents and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they only have a certain window of the year they can do it. And so everybody's always going, what will we discover that we've never seen before that's amazing? And when they get down there, sorry to spoil it if anybody's going to listen, but listen anyway. What is kind of interesting to him is they get down there and there's this like yellow fuzz growing everywhere. And they cannot figure out what it is. Well, it's some kind of a bacteria that just, it looks like yellow fuzz, and there's this other stuff that it supports. But everybody's kind of mad at him because they didn't discover something crazy alien.
Hmm.
And he's like, this isn't enough. Look where this is located. Look how much of it there is. It's flourishing. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
And that was the same kind of thing where I was like, why is stuff like that never enough for us? Why don't we look at it and go, we have been placed here. If you're a Christian, we have deliberately been placed in the greatest wonderland ever. And there's still stuff we're discovering that we haven't known about. Just the other day, I was reading about some species of something where, you know, oh, they'd never known about this before. Here it is, living in some forest. And I'm thinking, but we don't appreciate it. And I'm just as bad. You know, I shut myself up in my house, and I don't even go out in the backyard. And when I do, I like, oh, I didn't know bees were active right now. Look at them all in these flowers. Yeah. I mean, there's wonder for us everywhere we look.
It sure is. Yep.
It doesn't mean I don't want to see an alien planet sometime, but I'm just saying.
It's amazing. Just amazing.
And so when you read about, you know, like you're talking about, we're not going to get to artificial life anytime soon. It just makes me appreciate how difficult, what kind of a genius came up with this. Well, it's a genius that I can't even imagine, I guess, because it's God. But
The
mind of God. Good heavens.
Exactly.
We would never have designed a tree. It's too messy. All those leaves. I do that. They fall down. I got to rake them up.
You bet. All right. Well, yes. Thumbs anyway, up on sorry. This book. You bet. No problem. I'm almost out of time.
I know. We've gone on too long. I'm sorry.
That's all right. So is there anything else you want to, did you want to talk something extra or what do you want to do? I've got maybe about 8 minutes, and then I really need to run.
Well, let's just talk about what's coming up next, I guess.
Okay. Yeah, and what is coming up next is the movie In Bruges.
Mm.
Yes. A good Lent movie. Definitely rated R for language.
Oh, and violence.
And violence. Violence
lots
down the mine.
Language and violence.
Yep.
But so rich.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, if you don't like language and violence, I don't know if you'll like this movie. You couldn't probably watch this movie. It's R for a good reason. I can't believe it's not more than R. But it's moral and redemptive. And in fact, our Catholic Women's Book Club, somebody brought it up just the other night as, here's a place where you find all these things that we strive for in the middle of the mess that we make for ourselves.
Uh-huh.
She's like, there's no better movie for looking at this.
Right.
And then we immediately had to warn everyone, okay, if you don't want to hear the F word about 1,000 times.
In different accents.
Yes. By many wonderful actors. But it's also funny.
Yeah, sure
beautiful.
Is.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
So it's really great. And then I've chosen the next book.
All right.
People might want to start reading now if they haven't read Jane Eyre.
Jane Eyre, yes.
We're going full girly classic.
Fantastic.
On
girly classic. I've got it loaded on my Kindle. So, it's going to be done.
Yep. Fantastic. Well, speaking of the Kindle, did you want to talk about that at all really quickly?
Oh, sure we can. You bet. Yeah, we just had a conversation because on this book, we mentioned at the beginning that the Subterranean Press has these gorgeous books and things. But I have really made the shift to digital. I'm just so happy with how this has evolved that... You know, gosh, the other day I actually even was looking for something and it wasn't available for my Kindle, so I looked for something else. I mean, it's gotten that far, and I've been giving away and selling a lot of my paper books, just because I don't know. I just love it. I love that I can. It's on my phone. It's on my Kindle. It's on my computer.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like carrying a book with me all the time. It's on my phone. So if I'm in a situation where I've got a half an hour, I can read. I just love every aspect of it. I've just been thrilled with it. And then you're kind of the opposite.
I know. It's really funny. For me, the Kindle, if it's a book I can't get any other way, like this book we just talked about, because the other is so expensive, then that's fine. But I find that things like marking notes is very difficult for me because I want the context of the page it's on and where it is in the story. So I have to mark a lot of the book in order to get what I want. And I find that I really relate a lot to where something is on a page in terms of finding it again. And I just like having a book. Now, it doesn't mean I don't use the Kindle. I use it a lot for things I used to get the library to send me books for so I could read the first chapter of a book to see if I even wanted to read it. I download samples all the time from Kindle. And I will also download a lot of the Project Gutenberg stuff that's free, that's really old, that sometimes it's hard to get. And I will Kindle, a lot of times somebody has very kindly formatted those books and uploaded them so they're free. And I'll download a bunch of those. And the library now, I think, also is allowing a lot of free downloads. And I haven't tried Kindle's free borrowing thing because I am a Prime member. But I plan on doing that sometime if I ever get to where I don't have so many books to read.
Yeah, that's neat.
And so that's all very handy and everything. But I, what I find is that I'll read a book I really like this book, and then what I want is the real book. I go searching for it. I have gotten rid of a bunch of other books.
I see, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and for me, like, I'm reading Life Cycle of Software Objects. When I read it on the Kindle, I click on just this one button. When I find something that I want to highlight, I just click on the button, and then I can select what I want, and then I click it again. And so, you know, for this podcast, for example, I just clicked on View Notes and Marks, and it shows me everything that I've highlighted, and I can flip through it all. And then
it show it in the story?
No, it shows it separate from the story.
Right.
But I can flip through them all, and then when I click on, how much do these Digients start out knowing is something that I highlighted, and I click on that, and now I'm right there in the book. And I can
go backwards and forwards. Okay, well, that's what I was wondering, because
And not only that, but that highlight is on my phone, and it's on my computer. It's everywhere. So... it's just like, it works for me so very well. And I've made the switch kind of in other places too. I still have a written journal, but I don't write in it all the time, but sometimes I want to get away from the computer and I write in that.
Yeah.
But what I've done, and this will probably make you laugh, because I've switched to Evernote. Evernote has become, it's changed how I do everything. So Evernote is a program that you take notes in, and again, it exists on your PC and your Mac and your phone. You know, so any change that I make in my phone shows up everywhere else. So at work, it's super handy because if I've got like an instruction manual or something, if I put that in Evernote and I'm out at a piece of equipment, and normally I would have to go back to my office to get this manual, but now it's on my phone.
Because
I put it in Evernote, it exists on my phone. So,
well, and you know, manuals are one thing. I don't mind that at all because that's not the kind of thing I'm going to sit around and read or read in bed or whatever. And I'll read the Kindle, but it did occur to me that I don't mind that kind of thing. But the funny thing is I use note cards to take notes. And I just move the note cards around with me. That's fine. I put them in my purse and then I'll bring them out at home and I can flip through them. And what I have to do, in fact, when I get on the computer, it's too tempting for me to, I'll check email, I'll look at Goodreads, I'll look at my blog, I'll do all these things. For me to actually do some of the writing that I've got to do because I have deadlines coming up for it, I have to handwrite stuff. And I don't want to handwrite. Typing's much faster. But I have to either handwrite it or I have to use my laptop because for some reason on my laptop, I have a different mindset where I will allow myself not to check all those other things. I don't know why. It's weird. So,
and I know a lot of writers who have a computer that is not connected in any way to the internet. And that's their, it's like, that's my job. And then they have other computers for checking stuff with.
But for me, it's so cumbersome in a way to have to like, I like, okay, here's my InDesign since that's what I am used to working in. I'll just write in that. Here's my InDesign file. Well, now I have to send it to myself or save it somewhere or whatever because I've got to be able to pick it up at work too. I would rather just have the notebook you know, but eventually I'm going to put it in the computer. So then I'm still dealing with the same problem. So it's funny that.
Yeah. So what I was saying, if I just so I do have the written journal.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But no, you're fine. But what I do with it is at the end of every month, I scan it in and put it in Evernote. So.
Journal.
Now, yeah, exactly. So now, because I have stuff in my journal that sometimes I'm like, you know, I could be at a bookstore. Uh-huh. Which I don't do very often anymore because the bookstore I used to go to actually closed.
Oh.
Probably because of people like me.
Right.
Which, you know, makes me sad. But anyway.
it's the world we live in. What it choice is the are you world we make? Live in.
Yeah, what choice are you going to make? But anyway, you know, so wherever I'm at, if I need to look something up, it's in there. You know, the phone is really handy for having stuff with you. Mm-hmm. It's not very handy for putting stuff in. I like to be able to put it in on the PC or my Mac and then just mm-hmm. have it there. You know, well, it works just so darn well.
You bring up one other interesting thing that my husband has often said, you know, you need to print out some of your key stuff from your blog
mm-hmm.
so that we can have it somewhere so that if the software changes, if Blogger shuts down, how are we going to look at this? How would your grandchildren look at it? Mm-hmm. And know what you were writing and stuff. And I'm like, see, then we're back to format.
Yeah.
Our format's going to change so much that that's not accessible anymore. They'll have moved past it, but the books will still be there.
The books will still be there. And that's true. I know that there's a service out there that that will print your blog in a book.
Yeah. And you know how much I put on my blog?
Yeah.
Even if I just did the essential things for 1 year,
1,000-page,
it's going to cost so much.
East of Eden.
Yeah. Sadly, just for the, I was like, I tried looking at 1 year and taking out every piece of little just blah, blah, blah I put in and just the basic stuff. It was going to cost like $150. And I went, okay, that's not going to work.
Oh, awesome. Yeah,
so I kind of dropped it. I'll have to maybe just copy and paste or, you know, pull the stuff out and put it in something and print it out. But mm-hmm. yeah, because that was an attractive idea, I thought.
Yeah,
but
that would be kind of neat.
Oh, well.
All right.
Your time's up, I'm sure. Everybody's time is up.
You bet.
We've gone on.
Well, thanks for sticking with us, folks. And
we've been
have a wonderful day and treat your software well.
Yes. Be kind to your computer and those you meet online.
That's right. All right. We'll see you later, everybody.
Yeah. In 2 weeks, everyone, for In Bruges.
Bye-bye.
Bye.